Hello, and welcome to another historical podcast. Once again, it's myself, Matt Nelson, and Wayne Bridgman. So for this podcast, we turn our burning, lidless, one-eyed gaze onto the new world, to the 1800s, to the newly reunited USA.
Yes, they were, by that point, the United States of America, very much so. That's right, it's the late 18th century in America, Matt. They've just fought a bitter civil war, as I'm sure anyone listening to this will know. The slaves have been freed, and the United States is looking to expand further out into the West. Now, at this stage in history of the US, the war had split the country in half. North versus South.
Brother against brother.
Ideology against ideology.
Slave versus master.
It probably went down as far as cat versus dog.
Or ant versus termite.
Single-celled amoeba versus bacterium.
Yeah, and all of these things were in their regimental colours fighting each other.
Bitter.
The American West at this time was an ever-moving frontier of the American nation, and it was a veritable tinderbox of tension between the reunited States of America, expanding west, and the current dwellers of that land, the Plains or Red Indians, or perhaps politically correct Native Americans. So to give some context of why this was the case, Wayne?
Okay, a bit of background then. So for over a century, the Indians, obviously the original inhabitants of the country, had lived there for possibly thousands of years, maybe longer. And they were a bit fed up of making way for the white man.
The white devil.
The white devil. The east coast of America had housed the American population for the most part, and that population had been heading ever westward.
Yes, in fact, actually, they reckon that...
Westward ho!
They reckon that the population was growing so fast, it was often quoted as doubling in size each year.
Is that that why so many Irish went there?
Why?
They heard it was Dublin.
So to house the people, they needed more land, and expanding into the west was the place to go. This was called westward expansion. It was the belief in the American psyche that it was their rightful destiny.
God bestowed, in fact.
Yeah, to live and own all of America. They called this manifest destiny, the destiny of the American people.
So it was. It's a bit like the... And I'm not drawing any parallels here, but I'm just saying...
Why am I nervous?
Please don't write in. Is it comparable to like the... like, for example, the Nazi philosophy of Lebensraum? You know, the... The destiny to own the east of Europe. They felt, you know, they had the blue eyes, they were Aryan, it was their right to take this land and populate it themselves.
Yeah, with the blue-eyed blondies. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure the Americans would be like to be compared to Hitler's Germany.
Yeah, I wasn't doing that, actually.
But I do see where you're going with it. It is almost like a psychological desire to own a piece of land.
Just an example.
It's a handy vision. If you want to take land from an indigenous people, it's good to have maybe an ideology for that justification.
Yeah.
So by the 1860s, the US government had two ways of dealing with the current inhabitants. Of that, they could agree new treaties with them and move them into new locations or reservations. This had worked in the past, but the understandable feeling now from the Indians was that the white man did not keep to these treaties.
Broken them more than once by this time.
Exactly. So the treaties were, you know, just used to sort of keep them in a place. Yeah, yeah. And then actually break them when they were in a position to take advantage.
Divide and conquer.
Exactly. Typically, these treaties involve moving the Indians out of fertile, inhabitable land into more arid and inhospitable areas. Yeah. But the Indians were hardy people, and they could actually cope in these conditions as opposed to probably the white people.
Still would have objected to it, though, of course.
They didn't want to do it, yeah.
Well, or there was option two. They could exterminate them. You know, sometimes violence is the only way. And largely, the government preferred option one to two. But there are a lot of people within the US military and indeed the government at that time that thought option two had a lot of legs. And those legs, Matt, went right up to the armpits.
Absolutely, and were probably quite hairy. A number of the Americans had a clear view of the Indian problem.
I've never in my life seen a good Indian. Except when it's a dead Indian. God damn, Indian.
Yes, so there was a view that this massive, huge landmass of America was not going to be big enough for the two of us, race-wise. One side had a great knowledge of the land, Matt, mm-hmm. and felt that no man can own the land. You can merely pass through it.
It'd be illogical to them to think otherwise.
It would, yeah. I mean, they believed Earth and man should be as one.
A bit like the 1970s hippies.
Yeah, the hippies were probably a little bit less murdery.
Charles Manson.
Yeah, good example. But the important thing is the other side had Gatling guns.
That's going to be the difference.
Yeah, and obviously with that, coupled with a desire to create the world's largest democracy, it's going to be a problem. And that was their policy for most of the 18th century, of course.
Also, further background to the expansion. After the War of Independence, England had largely removed itself from the affairs of America. But France still owned areas of the country. And in 1803, the US made the best, well, that and the purchase of Alaska, deal in history with the Louisiana Purchase, with the acquisition of 828,000 square miles of the territory of Louisiana.
Wow, good deal.
Yeah. The US paid 50 million francs plus cancellation of debts worth 18 million francs. A total sum of 15 million for what is a gigantic portion of land that France had little use for. So why did France do it? Well, France at that time was embroiled in the Napoleonic War. Just had the revolution, mm-hmm. and they needed all the money they could get. So it was quite opportunistic for the Americans. As France was gobbling up huge swathes of Europe, owning parts of America seemed pretty less strategic to them than it had in the past.
Well, especially when their link to the country, navy-wise, was effectively broken. They were at war. You know, the British wouldn't have let them trade with the States. So.
Yeah, may as well. Yeah, cut the losses.
Yeah, so now, with Louisiana being east of the river, and with the constant doubling in size of the population, the Americans started to migrate west of the river, and again looked to push the Indians still further west before proceeding to populate the land they'd just bought off the French.
Mm-hmm.
So this was made worse for the Indians after the Civil War had ended, due to the fact that to unify the country and show it was the United States, mm-hmm. inverted commas, they started to build the Transcontinental Railway and have their own little industrial revolution from east to west, making it easier to migrate and do business across the country.
And it may not be that obvious, but that transcontinental railway also affected another part of the Indians' way of life. The buffalo. Is that Dr. Zoysberg, or is... What's that?
That's the buffalo.
Oh, of course it's a buffalo.
It's in the ambience.
I stand corrected. That is obviously a buffalo.
Yeah. No, the bison. It's a bison. That's why you didn't get that.
That's the reason. Right. Yeah. The government had realised that a war of attrition with the Indians could take years and countless lives to win, if it was indeed even winnable.
Mm.
But they had worked out that the buffalo was everything to the nomadic Indian. The tribes followed the herds and used every single part of the buffalo in their way of life.
Yeah, be it meat for food, or perhaps skin and hide for clothing.
Maybe to wear a loincloth.
It's hot over there at times, so yeah. Yeah. Bones for tools, used buffalo's teeth for spears, I think. Toys for the kids to play with.
Yep.
Everything was used. Even the stall of the creature.
What, even the sheep?
Yes, even that. Burnt it for fuel in their campfires.
There you are.
Yeah.
There we go.
Hopefully that's where the use of it ended. Yeah. Anyway, don't get too bogged down. Yeah. In that, so
early pioneers, maybe Mad Max took the.
If you can't beat the Indian on the field of battle, then what do you do, Matt? You break down and kill his way of life, strangle the life out of them. So, therefore, mass killings of the poor old innocent buffalo became official US policy.
You see. So there are photos of these guys, right? They're jam-packed on trains going east to west on this transcontinental railway. They're hanging off the trains and they're firing their rifles into great herds of buffaloes, randomly killing as many as they could.
Oh, God.
Did you know when you shoot a buffalo, Wayne, in a herd, the other buffalo, instead of running away, They just stand still.
Well, it could be talking natural selection here.
Yeah, a massive issue, as you say, a Darwinian proportions for the survival of your species. You know, so if you don't run away when someone's shooting you, Jesus, you know, you haven't got any chance, have you? So one man with a Henry repeating rifle could take down almost a herd on his own.
I recall, actually, from in the distant mists of the memory of my history class at school, actually, Matt. That,
yeah, Mrs. Beattie's history class, which we shared together.
Yeah, mentioning no names.
All those years ago, Edgebarrow.
Yeah, I remember the photos of thousands. I don't know if anyone else has seen this. Thousands of buffalo skulls just stacked up in a giant sort of bone pyramid.
Yeah.
All stacked up on top of each other, so high, you can just make out a tiny figure at the bottom in the corner of the photo. By this mountain of skulls, a cowboy, obviously. Mm-hmm. We'll put that photo on the Twitter feed, actually, at some point if you want to see it. It's pretty horrible.
It's an amazing photo. We'll also put some other photos on the Twitter feed. So we're going to put the picture of the cowboy shooting the buffalo on the Transcontinental Railway. Because, you know, that was a very widely sort of practiced, and there's photos knocking around there. So by 1870s, there were still some buffalo herds in the plains. So this meant that some of the Indian tribes could still exist outside of the reservations. But this culling of the buffalo enraged the Indians, and they hated it, as you could imagine. And they felt the white man had reached new heights of devilishness.
While they loved nature, of course, and another reason tension was very high, is that during the Civil War, a lot of the tribes fought for the South in the war.
Well, there you go. That's not often known.
Yeah, in some cases they were guides, and they did actually fight in some cases too. Yeah, you know, surprise attacks, ambushes, and the repercussions from the north to these traitorous tribes, as they saw them, was pretty harsh and brutal. So, the Cherokee, in particular, for example, took a battering after the war due to their allegiance with the South.
Yeah, and a lot of the generals from the north. Sheridan, Sherman, and a certain George Custer were all now focusing on the Indian problem. Most had a view that the Indian people and the white people could not coexist as separate nations. Assimilate or die.
And of course, as we often see in war, atrocities on both sides were happening regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So American pilgrims were found stripped and scalped, sometimes worse.
Yeah.
And the Indian villages were raided and innocents killed, and often scalped in return.
Yeah.
And the list goes on, some pretty horrible stuff that happened, but we're not going to cover it here.
Because
people might be a bit squeamish. So, the West, as we said, was a tinderbox, just about ready to ignite, as tensions were boiling over.
So onto this stage is a swaggering, cocksure, George Custer. So to give you a bit more detail on him, let's look at his life up to now, Wayne, shall we?
All right. We will.
Good.
Yes.
That's a nice natural segmentation into the next section about George Custer.
Well, George. George Custer. He was born on December the 5th, 1839, in a small town off of New Romney. That's in Ohio.
Ohio, yes. Good old Ohio. Swing state.
As a child, he was fascinated by all things military. His father used to dress him up as a child in a mock army uniform and take him to see the local soldiers doing their drills and stuff, you know. Sounds a bit like a guy from the last podcast. I hope he's not going to turn out to be as crazy.
Yes, yes, a crazy Roman megalomaniac ruler. Thankfully, Custer was nothing like Caligula. For those who have not listened to Caligula, it was our previous podcast. Please download it. But he did not lack personal confidence either. He was no shrinking violet. And he was convinced he could make a better life for himself. After he graduated from high school, he set his sights on heading to the famous West Point Military College. But he lacked the qualifications many of his other candidates had and needed backing. So he started to cozy up to the local congressman and gain the man's endorsement to put him forward with his support. And Custer enrolled in the school in 1857.
Now, Matt, it's worth saying here that it's believed Custer had a soft spot.
Or is it a hard spot?
That will make sense, what Matt just said, when you hear I say, for the congressman's daughter. And to get the hormonal, troublesome Custer out of his daughter's life before things got too hot, and she got Custer creamed, Get it?
UK biscuit joke.
Yeah, biscuit joke.
1980s. 90s.
So that congressman offered to sponsor Custer to West Point to get him out of the way of his daughter.
Yeah. It's worth saying that the custard cream of which that joke was made was the height of biscuit technology in the 90s until the old hobnob came along.
It was,
really.
It was basically superseded by the hobnob.
Hobnob.
Because it was chocolate based.
But West Point was not a perfect fit for the young cocksure peacock.
Once you've had chocolate, you never go back.
Yes, peacock-like Custer.
Yeah, sorry.
Despite his longing to climb a higher rank in life, an element of rebellion ran through him like a badly cooked vindaloo.
Mm.
We've all had that one for us, haven't we?
Different type of Indian, but carry
on. He buckled under authority, even at this stage, and did not like taking orders. And this led him to finish last in his class upon graduating. In June 1861,
George W. Bush in the top 87% of his class.
But he also got chucked out many times. Idleness and not obeying orders, a trait I'm sure, Wayne, you're familiar with.
Yes, whatever you say, sir.
But this trait will continue throughout his life, though.
Well, then, just a few days after graduating, he failed as the officer of the guard to prevent a fight between two cadets.
Oh.
Yeah. So, as a result, seems a bit harsh, but he was court-martialed as a result of that, and he could have been chucked out of the army right there and then altogether. But he was saved by a fluke.
What was that fluke?
Well, that very small event, tiny little fluke there, which saved him, was the outbreak of the American Civil War, actually. And the North was in desperate need of very poor officers, like he appeared to be.
So, a victim of good fortune? Custer's reputation was made during the Civil War, and it's hard to argue against him being a hero in this war. Certainly was the pin-up boy of the North.
What, for...
The poster child.
For gays, presumably, then?
No, he was just very successful. Oh. He rose through the ranks of the military during the war. It was astronomic. He rose from second lieutenant at the beginning of the war to major general during the last year of the war.
Yeah, and just for those of you who aren't familiar with the structure of the American military ranks, second lieutenant to major general is quite a lot.
Thanks, Wayne.
It's good going.
What I liked is I think you probably put to bed any questions they'd have about that. But he joined, Custer joined the right place for someone with his flair and imagination and probably his recklessness. He joined the cavalry.
Yeah, and being in the cavalry was the right place to be in this war.
Yeah, unlike places like Agincourt in the previous wars.
That's right, yeah. But in the States, a fearless charge... Still at this time, Matt, you know, late 19th century now we're looking at, the cavalry were still there, still doing their job, and a fearless charge at the right moment, in the right place, can turn a battle and thus bestow glory upon the dashing commander. And the typically successful cavalry commander, of course, as Custer hoped he fitted into, would be dashing, brave, fearless... And maybe a little dose of reckless insanity thrown in. Certainly get you the ladies.
Or
the boys.
Yes, enough of that. That played to Custer's strengths in spades. He featured in many of the key battles and seemed to be in the right place at the right time during most of these key battles in the war. But the major battle of the war was held on June 31st of 1863.
Bring it back. Yeah.
It was the Battle of Gettysburg. Of course. Custer had been promoted from captain to brigadier general at the age of 23, and he lost no time in planting his aggressive character onto his brigade.
So the 2 days prior to the action at the Battle of Gettysburg, Custer fought against the Confederate cavalry at Hanover and at Huntertown on the way to the main event at Gettysburg.
Of course, yeah.
And I'm not sure if this is great for his men necessarily, but Custer's style of battle was often claimed to be reckless or foolhardy. Two words that don't always go that well in war if you're fighting under the guy who's practising it like that. But there was military planning, however, in the foundations of every so-called Custer Dash. To explain, we've got a quote from Marguerite Merrington, who explains the Custer story in letters.
George Custer meticulously scouted every battlefield. He gauged the enemy's weak points and strengths, ascertained the best line of attack, and only after he was satisfied with the Custer dash with a Michigan yell, he focused with complete surprise on the enemy and routing them every time.
Thanks, Marguerite. Now then, you're probably thinking to yourselves, listeners, what is a Michigan yell? Well, it's, One of Custer's greatest attributes, actually, during the Civil War, was luck. And he needed it to survive some of these crazy charges that he performed. And Custer established a reputation as an aggressive cavalry brigade commander, willing to take a personal, and risk of his men as well, personal risks by leading his brigade into battle from the front with these mounted charges, like at Huntertown and in East Cavalry Field,
well,
at the Battle of Gettysburg.
In fact, at Huntertown, the story of Custer may have ended, as he almost died. An ill-considered charge ordered by his commander against the South. Custer fell from his wounded horse directly before the enemy and became the target of numerous enemy rifles.
Wow.
He was rescued by a comrade of the 1st Michigan Cavalry, who galloped up, shot Custer's nearest assailant, and allowed Custer to mount behind him and dash to safety.
It's like something out of a film or something.
Okay, yes, there it is.
But back to Gettysburg. One of Custer's finest hours in the Civil War, as we mentioned, occurred just east of Gettysburg on July 3rd, 1863. Robert E. Lee, the leader of the South of the Confederates, probably need to tell you guys that, but they are, had dispatched cavalry on a mission into the rear, don't, Matt, of the Union Army in a cunning plan to win the battle quickly.
Yes, Custer encountered the Union Cavalry Division of Brigadier General David McCurdy Gregg. Bit of a mouthful. Directly in the path of the South's charging horsemen. He convinced his general to allow him to stay and fight, as his own division was stationed to the south of the action. For hours and hours of charge, counter-charge, hand-to-hand combat, Custer eventually led a mounted charge, breaking the back of the Confederate assault.
And that was one of the main actions, actually, which stopped Lee's plan that looked like being successful up until that. What seemed at the time small turnaround, you know.
It was the key point in the battle.
It turned out to be one of the key points there. Maybe the turning point, Matt.
Yes.
Ultimately, Gettysburg was a Union win, of course, and ended up being the key battle in the war, and turned the tide forever in the Union's favour. It was like a knockout blow. The Confederates were reeling.
Yeah.
Now, that said, Custer's brigade lost 257 men in Gettysburg.
Jesus.
That is high. In fact, that is the highest loss of any Union cavalry brigade. So we're starting to get a glimpse now of when you say this guy's reckless, this is the effect it has on the men underneath him. You know, it's true. And I think this guy possibly, you know, as many great, in inverted commas, military men, is more interested in being the hero and, you know, getting all the kudos rather than the safety of his own men.
Yes, well, Custer, not wanting to brag, merely wrote of his achievements and said he played one of the most prominent parts in winning the war.
So, General Custer, great to have you here.
Great to be here, boy. How you doing?
Yes, excellent. Thank
Hello,
you
America.
You heard us talking about the Battle of Gettysburg there.
My
the part
Battle
that you
of Gettysburg. My battle, yep.
And the part that you played within it.
Very important part.
With your charge, of course. Well, multiple charges, really, but this charge in particular. How would you say that charge, how would you characterise that charge when it stands up against other great charges in history?
How's that come up against a great charge in history?
Yes.
Oh, man. I tell you what, I would challenge the annals of warfare, and I say that again so you understand, you're not blinking, you looking at me. I would challenge the annals of warfare Has a cavalry commander ever made a more successful and a more important charge?
That was my question.
Than I did at Gettysburg. And the answer is no, it was my charge in Gettysburg. It was absolutely vital to the war.
That's the best.
The best.
Okay, we'll just pick you up on that point then. How does that compare in that case to, say, Alexander the Great's charge at Gwagamela when he broke Darius's army? He was outnumbered massively.
Look, man's better. Man was better. I mean, I have not even heard of this Gwagamela, but man was better.
He was injured. He broke the whole army.
But just better, okay? Move on.
Okay, well, but why is it better when you compare it? What's the part of that charge?
Too much to go on about it. It was better charge than that.
All right. How about the Parthian lancers when they broke the crack Roman legions?
Man was better. Move on.
Or the charge of the Polish cavalry in 1683 when they broke the Ottoman ranks and saved Vienna.
Are you trying to embarrass me? You know, man was better.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, just better.
But we need for the listeners, why better? Why?
Look, this is better. Let's move on, okay? Look, I'm a leaving man.
Okay.
Get out of
here. Unhand me! Okay, he's gone.
Thank God.
Now, many more battles in the war occurred in which Custer featured and distinguished himself. In April 1865, the Confederate lines finally broke, of course, and Robert E. Lee began his long, sorrowful retreat pursued by the Union cavalry. Custer distinguished himself by his actions at a place called Waynesboro. Good name. At a strange place called, Dinwiddle Courthouse. His division blocked Lee's retreat on its final day and received the first flag of truce, Matt, from the Confederate force. It said Custer rode up and down the line of Union soldiers, waving the flag of truce and, you've guessed it, Matt, whooping like a maniac.
Hey, you hold up there! You guys want to guess what I got behind my back? Come on, have a guess now.
Really don't know, General.
I said have a guess. Come on, guys.
Flowers.
I got the flag of truce. The wars are over, boys. The wars are over.
We got it. Don't even speak.
Oh, fight. Oh, Rackers
here.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. The jealousy of generals is notorious and was put to the test here as General Grant, who was later to become the President of the United States,
was
a degree overshadowed by Custer and his historic moment.
When the surrender was signed, actually, Custer was presented a gift for his wife by General Sheridan, who included a newt to her.
A newt?
A note. Well, she loved amphibians.
He turned me into a newt.
Who included a note to her, praising Custer's gallantry, bigging him up.
Well, after the war, Custer dabbled in politics for a bit, but he fell out with President Grant. There was actually talk that Custer could have potentially run for president in the future had the Battle of Little Bighorn turned out differently than it did, and maybe he could have had a shot at the big job, but he would have messed it up. He was sort of more like a wartime general, really.
Yeah. After the war, Custer was sent against the Indians. On November 26, 1868, now Matt, Custer's scouts located the trail of an Indian war party. Custer's troops followed this trail all day without a break until nightfall, where they rested briefly until there was sufficient moonlight to once again resume the chase.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
When they reached the Indian tribe, the Cheyenne...
Or Cheyenne.
Cheyenne, whatever. And Chief Black Kettle's village at the Wichita River, Custer divided his force into four parts, Matt. Now, that might seem a bit strange for some of our listeners, but this was standard practice at the time to divide your force and cover all exits in this case. So each one would move into position so that at first daylight, they could simultaneously converge on the village. Attack at all sides at once.
Yeah, well, the Indians would be so busy just beating off the Americans from all sides.
Yeah.
So at daybreak, as the columns attacked, Double Wolf awoke and fired his gun to alert the village. It is indeed. Yeah. He was among the first to die in the charge. The Cheyenne warriors hurriedly left their lodges to take cover behind trees and in deep ravines. Custer soon controlled the village, though, but it took longer to quell all the remaining resistance.
Black Kettle and his wife, the oddly named Medicine Woman Later, were shot in the back and killed while fleeing on a little pony.
Who's fleeing on a little pony? Their daughter?
No. Somehow they both got on this pony, and I'm not surprised that they didn't get away.
Yeah, that was my little joke of Indian names there.
So they were fleeing on a pony, anyhow. Following the capture of Black Kettle's village, Custer found himself in a bit of a precarious position, actually, now, Matt. As the fighting began to subside, he saw large groups of mounted Indians gathering on nearby hilltops and learned that Black Kettle's village was only one of many Indian encampments along this river. Custer had a key bit of advice for his men before raiding this village.
Okay, so what's the plan, General?
Well, Benteen, I tell you what the plan is.
It's Davies, sir.
I don't care what the hell your name is, dude. You listen up here.
Okay.
When we go in the village, I want you to ride hard and fast. Secure all non-combat hostages before they have chance to escape.
Yes, sir.
Think this thing, okay? Think this thing. We de-encourage these
braves.
These brave warriors to fight, and thus we encourage them to surrender and
remove them
to themselves to the reservation.
Okay,
you get
sir.
That?
Yeah, sir.
Massively outnumbered and fearing an attack, and that he might be surrounded, he ordered some of his men to take defensive positions, while he ordered the others to seize the Indian women and children. His men made the women and children then sit on the horses and act as a human shield as they rode out. As they rode out, they saw to the hillside the vast hordes of the braves, the Indian braves, that were ready to launch a successful attack on them. But they did not engage, and they actually allowed Custer to escape. The Indians feared above all that their hostages might be harmed, and that made them feel impotent in regards to warfare.
So, mental note for later, the southern Cheyenne... encampment on the Wichita River comprised a key component in Custer's field strategy going forward now. So Indian non-combatants, women, children, were targetized by Custer for capture to serve as hostages and human shields. In theory, he could take out bigger encampments of Indians if he could get in quick and capture the women and children. Not very nice, is it?
But why was this so effective a strategy? Well, the Indians held, above all, women as the greatest of humans created by their grandfather, which was the version of their god. Let's hear from Chief Sitting Bull himself on this.
The woman, she can create life in their bodies, whereas a man must prove worth, needed to be brave and can't hunt. I, as man, show his worth through battle and feeding his family. A woman is closer to God than a man. How? Well, we worship her, and we worship the earth, father.
That's fine, thanks.
We have fire water now? So, Indian warriors feared harm above all else to their women, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Rightfully so. Custer was one of the few soldiers to realise this, and the success at the Battle of Wichita River perhaps goes some way to forming his strategy at the Battle of Little Bighorn, as we'll see a bit later on.
Yes. It's worth saying, actually, the Wichita River incident, a detachment of 20 of the soldiers under Major Elliot, they were scouting nearby and they received the brunt of the Indian rage. All 20 were killed, scalped, stripped, mutilated. Custer's abrupt withdrawal, scarpering out of there basically without determining the fate of Elliot and his men, who were just basically on patrol around the village, it darkened Custer's reputation among his peers.
Dear. Well, there was deep resentment, Matt, within the 7th Cavalry that never healed, actually, as a result of this, And in particular, Elliot's friend, and H Company Captain Benteen. Remember that name, Matt?
Captain Benteen.
Captain Benteen, yes. He never forgave Custer, actually, for abandoning his good friend Elliot and, of course, all the troops that go with it. So, 8 years later, Benteen failed himself to race to Custer's aid at the Battle of Little Bighorn without giving too much away. But his actions were closely examined in light of his long-standing anger towards Custer, actually, for the events at the Washita River. You know, we'll link that in later on.
So Custer remarked about his strategy to a journalist.
I think I've got the... Here's the quote, Matt, if you want to read that.
Yeah, it's from Custer. He said, "Indians contemplating a battle, either offensive or defensive, are always anxious to have their women and children removed from all danger. For this reason, I decided to locate our military camp as close and as convenient to Chief Black Kettle's Cheyenne village. Knowing that the close proximity to their women and children and their necessary exposure in case of conflict would operate as a powerful argument in favour of peace when the question of peace or war came to be discussed." Hell yeah!
So that's just like an open threat then, isn't it? By holding his forces nearby, saying that I'm here.
I can take your women and children.
I can hurt you if I want to.
At any moment.
Yeah, you need you need to worry about this.
Yeah.
Okay. So these hostilities have been simmering for a while. You know, is it an eye for an eye? A bit coy, but something now is going to spark off full-blown war. And is so often the way, in this case, it's not black gold, but what is it, Matt?
There be gold in their damn hills, I tell ya. Gold!
Exactly. Gold. So, remember, Black Hills this is. So, to recap the origins, as we've discussed for the Great Sioux War heating up in the 1870s, broken promises and violated treaties have made relations incredibly strained. They're ready to go.
Incredibly, yes.
In 1874, Custer led an expedition into the Black Hills and found...
gold there.
He found gold there. Yeah, yes. That's right. Yeah, thanks for it. this was to spell potential riches for the Americans, of course, and disaster for the Indians. Because they know the gold's there now in the Black Hills, which is in and about where these guys, the Indians, are living, the Native Americans, so...
Well, the Black Hills...
Prepare for a flood.
The Black Hills was a spiritual home for the Indians, a place where their god, Wakantanka, dwelled, making...
I beg your pardon.
Wakantanka dwelled, making it their most sacred land. Some things just can't be negotiated, and the white man mining for gold in their god's dwelling was a point of no return
for
the
Indians. They couldn't relate to it, could they?
No.
They couldn't relate to that.
You would expect, finding gold, it sparked off a gold rush. And soon a town was formed near the hills called Deadwood. And yes...
Yeah, that's the a hit TV show. And if you're an English listener, the one with Lovejoy's Ian McShane starring
in
it.
The hard-hitting Deadwood. It was set there. Deadwood's in the Black Hills.
And for those non-English listeners listening, he's a great actor. Go and see some of his stuff.
Yeah. And this town was raided and often the focus of a point, a sort of focus point for Indian and white man clashes.
The demilitarised zone. Well, except that there were two militaries in there.
Exactly, but the one thing wasn't demilitarised. That was probably the opposite of what it was.
The militarised zone. Okay, anyway, well, the government decided they had to have the Black Hills and asked the Indians to sell them the land. Worked before, didn't it, with Louisiana?
A fat person after a donut.
Yeah, well, this was, unfortunately, this was fat with gold, not just jam, Matt.
Yes.
So the Black Hills fell under the dominion of a tribe called the Lakota. You know them by a better name, the Sioux. Another big famous Native American tribe name there. And the leader was a chief called Tatanka. Get this right.
Yeah.
Tatanka. Yotanka. I think I did that justice, didn't I?
Yes, you did. That's very good. Yeah, Yotanka, okay. Tatanka.
And he said there was nothing that the American government could offer that would make the Sioux part with this land. To them, it was priceless. But the government turned up the heat and ordered all Sioux and neighbouring Cheyenne tribes into reservations.
Bastards.
Yeah. And stated that those not in those reservations by the summer would be considered combatants and therefore be in a state of war with the American people.
The great chief Tatanka refused to come to the reservation and sent out a message that this was a time that the Indians must make a stand now for the Black Hills and their way of life. Tatanka was respected by many Indians and his voice was heard, and many tribes began to make their way to his location. Perhaps the name Tatanka, Yotanka, is not familiar to you, for after all, it was his Indian name. We know Tatanka by a much more widely known name. Tatanka is known as Sitting Bull. He is perhaps one, if not the most famous Native American. So let's learn a little bit more about him.
Ah, interesting.
When I was a boy, the Sioux owned the world. The sun rose and set on their land. They sent 10,000 braves into battle. Where are the warriors today? Who slew them? Where are our lands? It is wrong for me to love my own. It is wicked of me because of my skin. Red, as the white man says. Because I am Sioux. Because I would die for my people and my country.
So, the battle is set, and Sitting Bull, inspiring the Sioux nation, was drawing them all together.
The demise of the Native Americans' way of life happened in a very short period of time. And the quote just read is Sitting Bull reflecting and seeing that way of life from its strength in Zenith through to its sad demise. To put it into context, this brave and wise ruler of the Sioux would end his days acting out the Battle of Little Bighorn to hordes of Americans in Buffalo Bill's travelling circus.
Oh, man.
Yeah, a sad end indeed.
Oh, very
for
sad.
A very noble man.
Yeah, definitely. So Sitting Bull was a young man, first went into battle aged 14, in a raid on another tribe, and saw his first encounter with the American soldiers in June 1863. When the army mounted a broad campaign in retaliation for the Santee Rebellion in Minnesota, in which Sitting Bull's people played no part, but it was a retaliation against them. They couldn't see right from wrong, Indian from Indian. The next year, Sitting Bull fought the US troops again at the Battle of the Killdeer Mountain, and in 1865, he led a siege against the newly established Fort Rice in present-day North Dakota. So widely respected for his bravery and insight, he became head chief of Lakota Nation in about 1868.
He was a brave sort, wasn't he?
He sure was. An experienced soldier.
Yeah. A story of his bravery goes like this, so it does. Once, in 1872, during a battle with soldiers protecting railroad workers on the Yellowstone River, Sitting Bull led four other warriors out between the lines. Sat calmly, sharing a pipe with them as bullets whizzed around, carefully cleaned the pipe out when they were finished.
Jesus.
And then just casually walked away. This guy has balls the size of melons.
Wow, balls the size of buffalo balls.
Well, I don't know which is bigger, buffalo balls or melons. Listeners at home, you can Google that and find out. Who knows what you'll get back. Anyway, now Sitting Bull was not just a fighter, but he was also a spiritual leader, of course. A medicine man. This, perhaps more than his bravery, made other tribes see him as the natural leader, as he could reach the spirit world. The Cheyenne also flocked to Sitting Bull, and an equally famous Indian chief, who was renowned for his bravery, led his people to war. His name was Crazy Horse. And he was to make his reputation even greater in the coming months.
So the scene is set for the coming Indian War. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, the Sioux and the Cheyenne versus the might of the American troops. This is a good point to leave the story now, and we will back with you with part two very soon.
When it's done. By the way, we will put up photos, some of which we mentioned earlier, about this period on our Instagram and Twitter pages of the same name, historical. So please follow us. Or see those there.
So until next time, as the late Leonard Nimoy said, live long and prosper.